So welcome everyone for our next installment of our JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning. Today it's coffee and sort of like a cheesecake and learning in honor of Shavuos, of the holiday where we at Mount Sinai ate a lot of milk products. So, you know, the rabbis like to say, well, the reason, you know, I don't know if you know the reason, the historic reason is very simple. The Torah existed only in heaven up until Mount Sinai. And then God gave the Torah to the Jewish people, and the Jewish people presented it to the nations of the world. So the laws of keeping kosher, specifically milk and meat, and more specifically, how to deal with meat, how to ritually shech to slaughter and salt and all the preparation involved, the people were clueless in the desert. Not clueless in Seattle, but clueless in the desert. They didn't know how to deal with meat. Why would they? So therefore, in the absence of law, because they hadn't been taught yet, they ate non-meat items. So they clearly would have eaten, let's say, dairy items or neutral items, but they didn't imbibe in meat. So we have a custom that sort of has been passed down through the generations that we associate milk meals or dairy meals with Shavuot to commemorate the original thing. I also think it could be that there wasn't a good, you know, maybe there was a really powerful, like, you know, cheesecake sponsorship deal there. You know, like we heard that, and then all of a sudden greens and what's the other famous, there's a couple of really famous cheesecakes from New York.
Juniors,
thank you. Junior himself was there at Mount Sinai. He said, come on, Moshe, I got a great sponsorship deal. You know, let's just, no meat laws. Yeah, juniors, that's right. So in honor of the junior sponsorship, this is our tradition. So again, welcome to our class. We're calling it, Do You Want My Torah? And the answer of the Jewish people was, Cowabunga, which is a nice way of saying, I'm in. You dive into the deep end and say, I'm all in. So I see Dr. Levin is looking to see, how many pages? No, I made it nice and large. And I really didn't need a handout today. I just did it for fun, just so we could have something to occupy ourselves. But I made it nice and large, and just three little items that will still not prevent me from going on for 4 hours. Joking. But you never need to look at what's written, you know? So let us have a little context before we begin with source one. So Matan Torah, the giving of our Torah, of our Bible. So when we speak of the Bible, obviously we are differentiating Tanakh, which is essentially a reference to Torah, the Bible, Nevi'im, prophets, Ketuvim, holy writings, for example, Psalms, the Book of Ruth, Book of Esther would be in the holy writings. Together, those 24 books make up what's called Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. Everything else, essentially, is Torah Shebalpa, oral Torah. But what is often overlooked is that even though we were given the Torah, the written law at Mount Sinai, Moses was also taught by God. That's why he had to spend, ready for this, a total of three ascensions, 40 days, 40 nights each. So if your arithmetic is correct, 120 days and nights he spent with God, whatever that means, on the summit of Mount Sinai being taught the Torah. And this is before the tragic events of the golden calf kind of messed things up with the shattering of the original vision of the Ten Commandments that was shattered, etc. We've had other classes on that in the past. And then post golden calf, again, he was with God. So what did he do for 40 days and 40 nights? We know he didn't eat, didn't drink, didn't sleep, but he was taught Torah. What Torah was he taught? So that is the oral tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh. So many people believe that the written law is sort of, that's the Torah. And the oral tradition, you know, sometimes they derisively refer to it as rabbinic Judaism. You may have heard that sort of title. It's really not true. The real Torah is the oral Torah. And that's why it's kind of a disservice. Because you can't interpret, dare I say, give Jewish law decisions based on a verse in the Bible without filling in the context for what it is. So let me just illustrate this, okay? So, for example, it says, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, right? So you often will see or hear people who speak for revenge. Their desire, eye for an eye, right? It's colloquially we use it, revenge. It has absolutely nothing to do with a literal translation. Never, ever, ever would any rabbi who's even remotely versed in Torah law ever say to you that if someone, you know, breaks your hand, that it's proper that a court should sentence that person to have their hand broken. It doesn't exist. It's absolute nonsense. It's garbage. Sorry. Now, it has been hijacked because the Torah was translated into Greek. It was called the Septuagint. It was translated under duress by a king. He was actually a Greek king who lived in Egypt. If you know the story of Cleopatra, it happened around the Cleopatra time. His name is King Ptolemy. Has one of those silent P's at the beginning of his name. King Ptolemy. He forced the rabbis, coerced them at gunpoint, or sword point, I guess, to translate the Torah, translate the Bible. So that was the first translation, was in the Greek. It became known as the Septuagint. That later was translated by the Romans, I'm sure, into Latin, etc. Now, when you translate something, you lose all the subtlety, the language. You know, we always say Lost in Translation. I think it's even a movie. Unfortunately, I was subjected to the pain of that movie once. Yeah, I'm with you. No, it's kind of funny. I'm sure it's a great movie. My wife says, you should give it a second. My best friend and bosom buddy growing up in Vancouver, Paul Karras, famous doctor, he and I, whenever I would visit Vancouver, we'd go out like guys' night out. So Rachel was home with little Tully. He was a baby, and we'd go out to see this movie. And we like going to movies, right? And had great reviews. Had Bill Murray. We love Bill Murray, right? Please do not see this movie, okay? It's one of those movies. Like, I walk out of the theater. I turn to my friend Paul. I said, Dr. Paul, I said, what was that? He looked at me and said, I said, was there anything redeeming? Like, I couldn't even hear the dialogue. It was very, like, everything was in a whisper, and it was all took place with this businessman who was in Japan. And you know, Scarlett Johansson, I think, was in it.
Yeah.
You know, right? She was the Marvel superhero. It again. So that was lost in translation to me. Okay, I promise you. It was like, stuff. You want to pain me? I don't even have to fast. If I would see that 3-4 times, I could give Yom Kippur a pass 1 year. That's how much it pained me, right? So to see it again, you say, Rabbi, you don't have to fast a Yom Kippur. You already did teshuva. You already repented by watching this movie 3 or 4 times. Anyways, so we even use that term lost in translation as things that are just lost. And if you ever try to translate from one language to another, good luck. You know, even taking something from, let's say, French that we use in our vernacular, right? It's very difficult with the subtlety and loss of language to communicate back and forth, even with a great translation. Doesn't work. And you know yourself, like Yiddish. You ever try anyone here conversing a little bit in Yiddish? So Yiddish has such great expressions, right? I'll give you an example. When something gives you pleasure and it gives you like a real, like a shot, we say it's a geschmack. But how do you translate the word geschmack? Like it even sounds like something that gives you like an elevation of like a feeling of greatness. Oh, that was a geschmack class, Rabbi. Like, it just, there's no way to translate the word geschmack. Again, when you take the words of our Torah, where each letter, and as any of you who were with us for the Rabbi Akiva class, even the shapes of those crowns can give us laws and insight and things. So you strip away the language of God, what we call Hebrew today, Lashon HaKodesh, this holy language, and you take all the subtlety of that language and you just throw it away and you make it into, it becomes Greek. You know, then it is what it is. No more, no less. There's nothing to be written into or read into. Doctor.
Well, I just have a really quick question. When you said the oral commentary, that includes Gemara and Mishnah, yes? And Torah. And
you said oral Torah, not oral commentary.
Oh. The oral Torah. No, I'm glad you asked, because I was coming to that.
Okay.
Just to clarify, everything other than those 24 books that begin with Genesis and ends with 2 Chronicles. 24 books. So the non-Jewish people refer to this as the Old Testament. Everything Old Testament is written law. Everything else is what's called oral law. Now, you mentioned the two greatest examples of oral tradition. The Mishnah, the 6 orders of the first framework for oral Torah called Mishnah. So any of you remember we sing that song, if you're able to stay up after four glasses of wine at the Seder, we goes, you know, who knows one? Echad mi odea. So we say, Shisha, Sidrei Mishnah. Six are the orders of the Mishnah. Five are the books of the Torah, right? So those six Sidrei Mishnah are the orders that Rabbi Yehuda, the prince, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, had to write down, even though it was oral and forbidden to be written down. He lived in a time of incredible Roman persecution, and he was very worried that what would happen if the oral tradition was passed on from father to son, mother to daughter, rabbi to student. What if there was a generation where, because of Roman persecution and pure, all-out evil assault on the Jewish religion, what if that transmission for one generation, what if it was gone? What if all the rabbis were massacred? One generation would mean the loss of the entirety of oral tradition, because it was just oral. So what did they do? They had an incredible gathering of rabbis, and they wrote down in a very short, succinct, brilliant framework, kind of like the cliff notes of what oral tradition would mean. And then I'm sure they made multiple copies offline so the Iranian and North Korean hackers couldn't corrupt the information. Maybe they buried a few copies here or there. Maybe the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, that's how they put manuscripts away in caves, because of the Romans and that. That's exactly why they did this. That little cult, by the way, they were kind of a cult, who hid what became later known as the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were not normal Jewish people by any stretch, but they had actual texts that they hid in that cave in Qumran, right? That became the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that's why they would do such a thing. In fact, there were even times where they buried Torah scrolls because there were fears of things that could get burned and looted and destroyed. So again, today we do the exact same thing, but we do it with technology, right? If you are a savvy consumer, you'll take all your photos and all the things that really matter to you, and you'll get a portable little hard drive, and you plug it into your computer or into your iPhone, and you sort of download all those photos and things that are so precious and dear to you, and then you have them offline. They're not connected to the internet. There's no access by anybody who can get to them. Short, God forbid, of an EMP, which would wipe out everybody, right? Electromagnetic pulse. Nothing. They're non-volatile. So we needed a non-volatile version of the Oral Torah. And that's why they wrote it down. That became the basis, by the way, the Mishnah, of the Gemara. And basically the Gemara is 2,700 plus folios, pages, double-sided, giving you all the expansive arguments that go into the laws of Judaism. So the Gemara is based on the Mishnah. And there are multiple commentaries on everything. All of this would be considered oral Torah Shabbat. So did that kind of...
Yeah.
Okay. So let's get back now to where we are. So we're at Mount Sinai. God gives us the Torah, the written version. It's not clear exactly what was given at the time on the original holiday of Shavuot, which we're commemorating tomorrow night for 2 days here outside of Israel, 1 day in Israel. But the Jewish people in Israel don't get off this time, you see, because they still have Shabbat. Aha! But it does put a little monkey wrench there, because you know what happens? For the next few weeks, we're going to have a different reading for our Parsha than they're going to have in Israel. Because this Saturday, they're going to read the regular weekly Parsha, whereas we, who are in exile, are going to read something in honor of Shavuot. So we're going to be like a week behind them, which is interesting. Just whatever. So let's get back to our story then. So Mount Sinai. Juniors, Cheesecake are sponsoring the milk, so they're eating a lot of milk products there at Mount Sinai. It's what we call the revelation. The Decalogue of Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments are given, the Jewish people jumped in. So that's where the cowabunga part is going to come in. The Jewish response to the Torah and the offer of the Torah. So remember something. We today as Jews do not have the ability, I mean you can, to opt out without consequences. Remember, all of us were signed and sealed on the yes, I accept the yoke of the Bible of the Torah by our great-great ancestors there at Mount Sinai. Now, there is a debate about the oral part of that transmission and when exactly they signed on, because there were elements perhaps of coercion in the minds of the people with Mount Sinai in terms of the oral tradition. But the letter of the law, the actual Bible, the Torah, we all said famously, when God said, do you want the Torah? We said, Nasa, we'll do it. Vinishma, and we'll hear about it. So that's going to be the basis for today. And we're going to try to understand the following question. There is a tradition that on the major holidays we have one of the Megillot, one of the scrolls that we read. The most famous of the Megillot, of course, is Esther that we read on Purim time, right? So on the holiday of Shavuot, we read the magical book that some of you have been studying with my wife, Ruth. Megillat Rut. Megillat Rus, if you're Ashkenazis. The Book of Ruth, the Scroll of Ruth, magical story. So why would that story relate to the holiday of Shavuot? It's not like, well, the rabbi said, well, we have five Megillas, and we got to pawn one off on all the major holidays, so let's just throw this one out there for Shavuot. Obviously, that's not the case. It must be that somehow the nature of Torah, the nature of the event at Mount Sinai, must be inexorably tied to the experience of Ruth and what Ruth is trying to convey to us. So I have some answers for you. So here's answer number one. The book of Ruth exists to validate the genealogy of King David. Unfortunately, there was a very bad man. His name was Doeg the Edomite. By the way, if you're Jewish and you're known as Doeg, doesn't that kind of sound like, you know, he's like, of course he's the villain. You meet him in scene two in your movie. And there's Doeg. Now remember, who are the Edomites? That's Esau, right? That's Esau's nation. So why are you calling a Jewish rabbi the Edomite? Probably, maybe like a hint. This guy's probably like the arch villain. And he was. Hated King David. Brilliant man. And so when King Saul, the first king of the Jewish people, who, by the way, was not from the rightful tribe of the kings, Judah. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, but he was appointed to be the first king. And unfortunately, he lost his way, and he perceived King David to perhaps be a competitor to his crown, which, of course, he was. So he asks his people around him. He sees that King David is the sparkling, shining, brilliant young man. And he loved King David because King David wasn't King David yet, right? Once he becomes King David, Saul's not a happy camper. But he wants to find out a little bit about King David's background. So let's go back. Judah is the king of the brothers, the rightful heir to the yoke of Malchut, kingship.
Excuse me, Judah is the king of the brothers?
Correct. In other words, Joseph was the king of Egypt.
Okay.
But Joseph's tribe was not eternally given the rights to the kingship of the Jewish people. The kings of Israel were all supposed to arise from the tribe of Judah. However, ironically, Joseph, his family, his descendants separate from Judah. You may have heard of that it was a northern kingdom of Israel and there was a southern kingdom of Judah. So the northern kingdom of Israel, which were the lost tribes ultimately, they were lost to us, that was commanded by children of Joseph. So it's kind of ironic that there was this pull, this dynamic between Joseph and Judah, Judah and Joseph. So King Saul is the first king of the Jewish people. He asks his greatest rabbi, Doeg, the Edomite, I want you to investigate this king, this David character. I know he's from Judah, which means he might be a competitor for the throne. But you see, Judah had two sons. He had twins through Tamar. If you know the story of Judah and Tamar, it's not going to be for today. It's a famous, famous story, Labriyut. And so what happens is, Judah's two sons are Peretz and Zerah. Peretz you probably have heard of before. Zerah became like a footnote in history. Who was the Bechor, the older of the two? The one who would be the heir to the throne, the mantle of the kingship? That was the oldest, Peretz. So Saul knows enough biblical history. He's a brilliant man. He says to Doeg, could you go research Judah's David's background? I know he's from Judah. Which side from Judah does he come from? If he comes from the Zerah side, who are not the heirs to the kingship, I don't care about David. But if he comes from Peretz, we need to investigate, and maybe I need to take some preemptive action against David. So guess what, Doeg? And you can almost hear this response, like with the cynicism and the sarcasm and the bitterness. Because Doeg did not like David. He says, Your Royal Highness, ask not which side of Judah does David come from. Why don't you ask if this kid, David, is even Jewish by Jewish law? So before you start getting all hung up about royalty, not royalty. Why don't you ask a very basic question? Is the kid Jewish even? Wow. So what was Doeg's issue? Doeg's issue is that there are two tribes, two families, and they became nations, who are literally in the Torah Shebichtav, in the written law. It says right in the verse, any member of these tribes will never marry a born Jew. They're disqualified from ever becoming Jewish. They can convert to Judaism and become Jewish, but they may not marry a Jew born of birth. They're excluded. Who are they? The tribes of Moab and Ammon. I'll read you the pasuk from my mind. You ready? It says, Ammoni u'Moavi lo yavo b'kahal Hashem. Any Ammonite and Moabite shall not ever enter into the holy congregation of the Jewish people. And I just explained to you the context. It means that they're not allowed to marry a born Jew. Even 10 generations post-conversion, meaning great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchild, no. They're forever off-limits. Why would that be? Because they did not offer, even for sale, for money, hospitality, hachnasas orchim, kindness to the Jewish people who were going with Joshua into the promised land. And they walked adjacent to the territories of Moab and Ammon, right next to Israel, which was known as Canaan at the time, Canaan. So they're passing by, and they're thirsty, and they're hungry, and there are 7-Elevens set up there that are run by the Moab Ammon nation. And they say, can we, please, we're parched, can we get a Slurpee, can we get a snack? And the Ammon Moab people say, pass on by, Jews. We will not even sell you for any price, any hospitality. So God says, whoa, you're excluded. So why would that be? So this is just a little off the record, but it relates much to who Ruth was, because that's our story. What defines a Jew? Our chesed, our kindness. How do we know this? Because the first Jew and Jewess were Abraham and Sarah. And the definition of what made a Jew, Abraham and Sarah, was their open heart, their willingness to share, their willingness to invite strangers into the home and have meals with them and be hospitable. So any nation that has sort of this, I'll call it a genetic flaw in their DNA, cannot be part of the Jewish people. So the Moabite, Ammonite nations, in other words, think about it for a moment, okay? This is how crazy it is. Egyptians killed Jewish baby boys. But after three generations of conversion, they can marry. Whoa! So you kill Jewish babies, we exclude you for three generations. You don't offer us food and hospitality. Never? Yeah, because God says, look, you can repent, and we can sort of like, three generations, remove enough of that garbage from your genetics that you can be part of us. So Egyptians, you're okay. Not so much Ammon and Moab. Where do you think Ruth came from? Moab! She's a Moabitess! So Doeg says, look, David, his great-grandma was Ruth. And he opened up a Torah and he shows King Saul, look, boom. No Ammon or Moab may enter and become Jewish. So Ruth is his grandma. How do we define her Judaism? By mom. So yes, good. Mazel tov. His great-grandfather Boaz was from Judah. Great. But that doesn't help his Judaism. He's from his maternal grandma. Ruth. He's excluded. So don't ask about Judah, which son, kingship. He's not even Jewish. What are you worried about? This is why, on a basic level, the book of Ruth exists. To explain for us why it's okay for Ruth to become Jewish. And it's 100% legitimate what happened. And it was a misinterpretation of the written law, remember we spoke about that at the outset, that led to Doeg's assertion that David was verboten. He was off limits. So what was the misunderstanding? That it was the men of Moab and the men of Ammon who came out and spat at the Jewish people and said, no way, over our dead bodies Are we going to share or even sell you food and water? Bye-bye. But it wasn't the women. The women didn't have this genetic flaw. So therefore, since Ruth is a Moabitess, when it says in the Torah, I'll read the words again in my mind, it says, Ammoni u'Moavi, a male Ammonite and a male Moabite may not enter, to exclude the females. Now, how would you know that, by the way, without oral tradition? You wouldn't. So if you only go by the written law, there's no King David. There's no Mashiach. There's no Messiah, because the Messiah will come from King David's legacy. But if Messiah is from Ruth, and Ruth is not really Jewish, and she could never become Jewish because the Torah excludes her, then there's no King David, there's no King Solomon, there's no temple, everything is invalidated, and there's no Messiah. Okay, let's just retire. So you see how critical it is that we have this Torah Shebaal Peh, this oral tradition. So along comes the great prophet Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel the prophet, and he writes this book, he authors this book of Ruth to validate. No, 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 he says, as a response to Doeg. You, Doeg, you dare to cast aspersions on David's family and on the glorious Ruth? Of course she's permitted, because it's excluding the women from the Torah law. It's not the Moabite women, it was only the men that were excluded. So shut up. Leave David alone. So it was all written to validate David and to run contrary to the vicious Doeg. Okay, so that then ties into Shavuot. You want to guess who was born on Shavuot? King David! Wow, he was born and died on Shavuot. So that's one reason that we would read the book of Ruth, because it ends with the heroic sort of legacy of Ruth, and it ends with David. So that's one reason. There's a bunch of other reasons. I'm going to give you another reason, which is not written anywhere except in my imagination. But we're going to do it right now, okay? So let's look inside. This is sort of the short version of the first chapter of Ruth. And we're going to be running through lots of verses that are omitted for brevity's sake. Ready? So during the time of the judges, when there was a famine in the land of Israel, a distinguished family from Bethlehem in Judah. Apparently there was a Bethlehem located somewhere else in Israel, but not in the territorial Judah area. His name was Elimelech, and his wife Naomi, and their sons Mahlon and Chilion. They emigrated to the nearby country of Moab. We're back at Moab again. Remember, that's where he's going to meet Ruth. Elimelech died there, and the sons married two Moabite women. Mahlon married Ruth, and Chilion married Orpah. Not Mrs. Winfrey, but Orpah. After about 10 years, the two sons of Naomi also died. So Mahlon and Chilion died, leaving Ruth and Orpah as widows. Naomi decided to return home to Bethlehem. She heard that the famine was over, and she wanted desperately to go back to her homeland. She told her daughters-in-law to return to their own families and remarry. Orpah reluctantly left. Stop there for 1 second. Orpah, her name means Oref, which is the back of your neck, that little sort of little point right here where your, I'm sure there's a name for that, where the joint, where the head sort of pivots. The Oref, it's called. So why is she called Orpah? Because she turned her back on Judaism. She had an opportunity to go with her former mother-in-law, because remember, her husband is dead. So Naomi technically is not really related to her, because the mother-in-law thing has kind of been broken now by the death of her husband. And she cries, and she weeps, and she gives a kiss to Naomi, and then she turns her back to Naomi and to God and to Judaism, and she goes back to her people, the Moabites. And she dedicates the rest of her life, and this is another class for another day, she dedicates the rest of her life to trying to undermine and destroy Naomi and Naomi's legacy and Ruth. She's so resentful of something that happened to her, which we're not going to go into. It was nothing real. It was just in her mind. But just to give you a sense of how bad it became. So here, Orpah and Ruth are both daughters-in-law, and they're Moabite princesses by birth. And they're accompanying Naomi for part of the journey, and Naomi sort of tells them, please go. I love you, but I have nothing to offer you. There's no marriage prospects for you. You're widows. You have tons of money back home in the bank accounts of Moab because you're princesses. There are better opportunities. So please go home. I have nothing to offer you. When I go home to Israel, I am bereft. Look at me. I'm old. I'm tired. People are going to look at me and say, well, you deserted us during the famine. You and your husband, Elimelech, you're no good next. We're going to ostracize you. That's exactly what happened tragically when they went home. So Orpah kisses it off. That's why the expression, you kiss it goodbye. She literally just kisses Naomi goodbye and goes away. And the Talmud, that's the oral tradition, tells us that every child or every grand product child that she had tried to murder King David at one time. The most famous being Goliath. Goliath is part of the lineage of Orpah. Comes from Orpah. The Goliath, the Philistine, who tries to kill King David, the famous battle, David and Goliath, he, Goliath, comes from Orpah, which is amazing, right? Because when they meet on the battlefield, you have Ruth's great-grandchild, David, Orpah's great-grandchild, Goliath, and things did not go well for Goliath that day, right? Good. So that's kind of an interesting side point. You see, I got all these other classes in my pocket that we could have fun with, but they're not going to happen today. I'm sorry about that. So now we get to arguably the most beautiful, most poetic verses in the whole Torah. They are poetic and heartrending because they are the heart and the feelings that Ruth has for God, for Hashem, and for Naomi, her mother-in-law. Both, on both levels it works. So these are so famous, they've written songs about them, and they're beautiful. So Ruth is responding to Naomi basically saying, look, Orpah just went home. My dear, I love you. Go home. And she starts to push her away and to dissuade her from coming and joining the Jewish people. And what is Ruth's response? I'll read it to you. Entreat me not to leave you or to return from following after you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do so for me and more also, if anything but death part you and me. Beautiful stuff. So the rabbis say that each of these verses, when Ruth says, because remember, it's a one-sided conversation right now. It's Ruth responding to Naomi, who's trying to sort of push her away from joining the Jewish people. We don't know what Naomi was saying. So the rabbis say, well, actually, you can figure it out. Because each of these lines sort of is an allusion to what Naomi must have said to her, and these are Ruth's responses. So, for example, maybe Naomi said to her, where you lodge, I will lodge. So Naomi said, by the way, you can't be a married man and a married woman from other people can't seclude together in private. It's called yichud. They may not be together in a room or anywhere. She says, okay, where you lodge, I will lodge. If it's good enough for you, I'm in. And then maybe she said to her, we bury Jewish people, non-Jewish people in different parts of the cemetery. So she says, okay, then I'm in for that. So clearly the rabbis sort of orchestrate, and they go through it point by point, that each time Ruth is responding to something that Naomi's saying in an effort, if you will, to sort of dissuade the lovely, gracious Ruth from coming back. Now, when a non-Jewish person comes to become Jewish, the rabbi doesn't go crazy, but their first question might be to that person, why would you want to become Jewish? Don't you know that the Jewish people are scorned and ridiculed and there's a lot of anti-Semitism going on and we're marginalized everywhere in the world and people accuse us of bad stuff and we've been persecuted over the generations? Like, really? You really want to join us? And then the rabbis say, and if the response is, Rabbi, yes, I do know the history of the Jewish people and I would be honored to join the Jewish people. So at that point, the rabbis say, stop pushing her away or him away, and then you go into the next stage of a conversion process. So clearly at the outset, the first job is to, is In other words, we're not skeptical, but we're just trying to understand what is the motivation here. Now, if the motivation is something, you know, well, I happen to have a boyfriend, girlfriend, that's a separate issue. We're not talking about that. But if that is sort of excluded, and that's not the primary motivator, then we get to sort of the rabbi questioning, I don't want to say the sanity of the would-be convert, but basically saying, I don't understand. There's 613 Torah laws, and there's only 7 for someone who's a child of Noah. Every person in this room and every person in our world is a child of Noah, because there's nobody else. So Noah children only have to keep 7 laws, and they're considered good and holy and everything great. Why would you add on 606 extra laws when you don't have to? In other words, it's a whole lot easier to be a righteous person when you only have 7 versus another 606. By the way, Ruth's name in Hebrew in numerology is 606. Oh. Very interesting. The Resh is 200, Tav is 400, and Vav is 6. So that's like she's adding the 606. Very interesting. So Ruth, then, in the context of the book of Ruth, is responding directly to Naomi. And Naomi is like looking at Orpah walking home to Moab. And she says, look, there's your sister-in-law. She's your relative. Go with her, please. Keep her company. I'm going home on my own. Thank you, my dear. I love you. But there's no place for you back in Israel. And what does Ruth say? I'm coming. But she says more than this. She says, where you die, I will die. Anything but death will part you and me. She says, I'm in this. And I love you, Naomi. And I want to come with you because you're my mentor. You're my former mother-in-law. And we have a relationship. And I want to become part of the Jewish people. And I want you to teach me more and more about being Jewish. And I want you to help me become fully Jewish. But guess what? If you will reject me, and you say to me, I won't do this for you, I'm still coming. With you or without you, I'm in. Kawabunga. I don't need you to be the one who facilitates my conversion. I would love you to be that person, but if you insist on pushing me away, I'm in. So keep pushing, dear. So at that point, the Megillah says that when Naomi sees that not only her attempts at pushing, verbally pushing Ruth, are not succeeding, but Ruth is actually gaining strength and resolve, then she just shuts up and says, okay, let's go. And they go together. So at that point, the rabbis say this was really a most amazing moment, right? Because who witnesses this moment? God, Naomi, and Ruth. We are only privy to this because of Samuel being a prophet and God kind of relates the story over. But it's in a very intimate moment, correct? Just between these two amazing ladies, Naomi, mother-in-law, Ruth, former daughter-in-law. No one else is there. And yet, think of the reverberations of that moment. King David, King Solomon, the Mashiach, the Messiah. Think of what that moment means for history. And yet it plays out in this little lonely road coming from Moab back to Israel. Wow. I mean, just, it's shattering. Yes.
Did Ruth know that she was a Moabite and thus she was not allowed to become Jewish?
Excellent question. So I would say at this point, no. But, the law that the rule of the Torah applies men but not women had been forgotten and was reinstituted by none other than the head rabbi of Israel, Boaz, future husband of Ruth. So it could be, excellent question, it could be that part of Naomi's fear was you're going to come back, but what life will you have as a Moabite convert? You're never going to be able to marry a born Jew. So she didn't want to sentence Ruth to sort of this life that would be limited. So it's excellent. That could be part of Naomi's reluctance. In other words, in addition to the fact that she was penniless and she was, you know, old and haggard and everything else, maybe she loved Ruth and she didn't want to subject Ruth to this marginalization at the hands of the people in Israel. Excellent point. Thank you for sharing. So what do you see here? What you see is there is text, and then there's subtext that doesn't exist within the text. Correct? I just sort of illustrated for you that, yes, the text is talking about what Ruth says, but it's a response to clearly what Naomi was saying. And then there's the larger context of what was going on that applies to us to this day in terms of the Messiah, in terms of the vision of the Jewish people and the future of the Jewish people. So you see how amazing it is. This is exactly what happened at Mount Sinai. Have a look at number two. God says to the Jews, hey, do you want my Torah? And they, the children of Israel, said, all that the Lord spoke, Naseh, we will do, V'nishma, and we will hear. That's from Exodus 24:7. So what does that mean? So source three, and I'll just tell you the rest of the story, as our friend Paul Harvey would say. God went to the nations of the world before he went to the Jews. Now, clearly we're talking in a way that I can't explain to you. I don't want to call it a metaphor, but it's more conceptual, okay? So just pretend with me. So God goes to all the 70 primary nations. Because remember, in the aftermath of the failed Tower of Babylon, humanity explodes and they leave the area of Mesopotamia and they go all points north, east, west, and south, Africa, Asia, Europe, and that's how you have this explosion of humanity after the Tower of Babylon. You had 70 primary languages and 70 nations. So those 70 nations were given first dibs at God's Torah. So God comes, I'm going to illustrate this. He comes to the children of Esau, older brother of Jacob, right? Close connection to the Jewish people. He says, Edomites, do you want the privilege of Mount Sinai and my Torah? And the Edomites say, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, we're in. And then God says, do you have any questions? So they say, well, you know, what does it mean? God says, it means that once you commit, you're in, for better or worse. There's reward and there's punishment. There's consequences for doing or not doing. So the Edomites are smart guys. They're kind of like when you go on Amazon and they give you a sample chapter or a sample song before you purchase, right? They say, could we have a sample chapter, please, of this Torah? God says, what? We'd like a sample, please. What's written in the book? Oh, God says, so you want to know what's written in it? Okay, fine. How about the sixth commandment, thou shall not murder? And they turn white. And the Edomites say, thou shalt not murder. God, we're Edomites. We have the ruddy complexion of blood and stuff. It's in our DNA. Wow. We take a pass. Thanks, God. And then he comes to the Moabites. He says, hey, you want my Torah? And once again, they say, yeah. There's consequences. Okay, fine. What's written in this Torah? Thou shalt not be promiscuous. No adultery. The Moabites, again, turn white. They say, oh no, my gosh. God, come on. We only came to be because, you know, our great-grandfather Lot slept with his own daughter. So that's kind of our nature to be lascivious. We're taking a pass on this one, God. And then he comes to the Ishmaelim, children of Ishmael. Some might say the present-day Arab population, but who knows? And he says to them, okay, again, Torah, sample chapter, please, God. Thou shalt not steal. And again, they're saying, thou shalt not steal. It's our nature to sort of, like it even says in the Bible, that our hands are going to be in everybody else's business and stuff. It's our nature to sort of pocket the extra cash. So if that's the Torah, we don't want it. And he goes to every nation. And then finally comes to the Jewish people. And we just said, you want my Torah? Yeah, we're in. And God's waiting for the other foot to drop. Okay, do you want that sample chapter? No. You don't want the sample chapter? No. You sure? I mean, it's serious stuff. If you say yes, there's no going back. It's for you, your grandchildren. For thousands of years, you're in, right? You want a chapter, a sample? You know what the response was? We're not interested in a chapter. Naseh. We're in. Kawabunga. I want it. You can teach us tomorrow. Nishma. We'll hear the details tomorrow. And God said, you're in. It's your Torah. Now, what does that mean? First of all, this is what I think it means, very simplistically. What would it matter what is written in the Torah if you want a relationship with God? A man and a woman meet, and the man, I'll use a Bambi term, is absolutely Twitter-pated with this young lady. This is because remember, this is a marriage. Mount Sinai is metaphorically a marriage between God and the Jewish people, and the Jewish people and God. It's a mutuality. So the young man gets down on his knee, and he gets the ring. He says, "Will you marry me?" And she's everything that he ever dreamed about. And she says, "You know, before I say yes, I just want you to know I'm a lousy cook. I don't like John Wick movies. I snore a little bit in my sleep." Whatever, she can throw out all these ridiculous things. The guy's going to look at her like, what? I love you and I want you the rest of my life. Does it matter to me? Okay, no. You'll watch Bobby Flay on the Cooking Channel on Food Network. You'll learn how to cook a little better. If you don't, you know, we'll get takeout. Does it really matter at all? Any of these things? It matters not. I want you. Who does that sound like? That's Ruth and Naomi, right? Naomi's throwing these reasonable things about Jewish law, and Ruth is like, really? You think that matters to me at all? I want in. Cowabunga. I'm there. Nasa Venishma. So the Jewish people, do you want a sample chapter? What would it matter, God? We want you. You wrote this Torah, yeah? Mm-hmm. It's your creation, yeah? We love you. So obviously it's perfect, and we're in. You can tell us the details tomorrow. It doesn't matter. We love you. We want you to love us, and we want this relationship. This is Mount Sinai. This is what we're celebrating. It's an amazing idea. So Ruth brings forth in that amazing little dialogue with Naomi, this sort of what we thought was a one-sided dialogue. It is a metaphor for Mount Sinai, the Jewish people, and God. And that, do you want to know what's written in it? Do you want your sample chapter? We're saying no. So this is the essence of what we're celebrating on Shavuot. Hence, we read the book of Ruth on Shavuot to celebrate, because that's what Ruth was. That's what Ruth brings that no one else ever brought. So we will wrap up now. We'll go off the record, as they say. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to follow up. Thank you, everyone.